Hello and welcome. This is Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and we are here for our Insulin Resistance Solution Practitioner Training. I'm excited to be here because I just love talking about this topic. I've had such wonderful experiences with seeing major transformations in people with the concept of turning off their insulin resistance, turning on their insulin receptors, getting them to manage their blood sugars, and the kind of amazing health changes that brings. So I'm always excited to talk about it. Just a little bit about me. I have been in clinical practice for over 20 years. I have a degree in nutrition, a master's degree in nutrition. I have certification in acupuncture. I have a doctorate in chiropractic. I have certification in herbal medicine. And basically I've got the piecemeal version of a naturopathic degree, plus 20 years plus of experience working with clients and working with, I would say over the last 10 years, most of that has been with the challenging cases, the difficult cases, those people who have been to a whole bunch of other practitioners before, are not getting results. When I say practitioners before, I don't mean just medical practitioners, because I'm sure you guys see that all the time. You see people all the time that have been through standard medicine and they're missing the boat on nutrition and herbal medicine and lifestyle changes. And when you get your hands on them, they make changes and they have phenomenal success. But there is that subset that doesn't. There's that subset that defies all the standard stuff, or so we think, that we put them on certain foods and certain programs and we get them off of certain things, but they still don't get the results you think they should. Yeah, they get better, but they reach a plateau. And when I started seeing those kinds of patients, I was freaking out. I'm like, wait, they've been to a couple of MDs and a couple of naturopaths and an acupuncturist, and now they're looking to me for help. I'm like, yikes, what do I know that all those other practitioners didn't? And when I applied my systematic approach, I realized that not everybody is as thorough or systematic, and that there's certain things that were overlooked. So I started digging, and one of the things that I found to be incredibly pervasive was blood sugar imbalance. And of course, I had learned, just like maybe you had in school, blood sugar imbalance. Yeah, you take people and you put them on a high carbohydrate, complex carbohydrate diet, and you get them off of sugar and you give them a few supplements and they're fixed. And in other cases, I heard, well, no, some people don't respond well to the high carbohydrate version, complex carbohydrate. You have to take them off the complex carbohydrates and put them on a high protein fat diet. And then there's the, well, fat doesn't work because it burns out the insulin receptors. And yeah. So I started a wholesale search and digging and digging and digging to find out, what could I offer these people that others weren't? How can I approach the problem of insulin resistance so I don't just halt it in its tracks, but I can help them to reverse it? And we'll go into why we want to reverse it and why you're in the right place if you're here, because insulin resistance is more than just an issue of increased waist to hip ratio, which everybody kind of knows about as a hallmark sign of insulin resistance, that the belly gets big, and that's kind of a nuisance. But I want to talk to you about the real serious things that can happen as a result, including Alzheimer's disease, which occurs when insulin resistance affects the brain. And that might be a totally foreign concept to you, as it was to me, because when I was in school, we learned that the brain didn't need insulin to take up glucose. It could just take it out of the blood. So that's a little bit about me. So I went on, and I've got a lot of people that I've taken through group insulin resistance reset programs with amazing results. And some of you may have already been on that program or know of the program that I'm talking about. And we'll talk more about that as we go on. But before I begin, I want to make sure that you understand that the information that I'm presenting is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional. It's not intended as medical advice, and the kinds of things I'm teaching you are not intended as medical diagnosis. I like to use the word assessment and evaluation, and I think you should get used to that word too, unless you're in a situation where you have a license to diagnose and you're sitting face to face. Now, if I'm sitting face to face with somebody, it's within my scope of practice to create a diagnosis and give them a diagnosis code. But if I'm working with a group of people long distance over the phone, it's not appropriate to do, and it's not within my scope of practice or anybody's scope of practice to do a quote-unquote diagnosis that way. But we can do assessments, and we can do evaluation, and we can educate our patients and our clients as to how they can take control of their lives, how they can alter the course of what is seemingly a degenerative disease, a very wholesale epidemic that medicine really doesn't have much in the way of solution for. But if you're working with people that are working with a medical practitioner who are on medication, you want to make sure you always caution them that they should not go off medication unless they consult with the practitioner who prescribed it. You cannot take them off medication unless you prescribed it. And also, if you're working through this program and you're taking some of the things I share with you tonight to work on yourself, which may very well be one of the reasons you're here, then also know that I'm not giving you medical advice. I am giving you education so that you can make really, really informed decisions that help you to reach the optimal health and help you to guide your patients and your clients to the most optimal health they can get. What I'd like to do is talk a little bit about what I intend to cover. This is just the beginning. There's a lot of great information that I will be sharing throughout the weeks, a lot of great protocols and ideas nutritionally, recipes even, that I'll be going through over the course. I want you to really feel good. You're in the right place. I want to talk about what insulin resistance really is, how it develops as well. Okay, there's a whole sequence of events that happens, and the biochemistry is quite complex. We'll go over that in detail, and in the course of the program, we'll get into a lot more detail about the various parts. We're going to talk about how you can detect insulin resistance in your clients years before conventional medicine would catch it. Okay, years before, I promise you, because conventional medicine doesn't catch it until it gets to a certain threshold, until the labs get to a certain point. They don't know the early warning signs, nor do they educate their patients as to how they can detect those early warning signs. I want to talk to you about the long-term consequences of unmanaged insulin resistance. And it's not just that the belly gets fatter. And it's some serious stuff, as you may well know, in some of the big killers and inconveniences that affect our older population as a result of long-term insulin resistance that was unmanaged. And a lot of these things are preventable. Most of these things are preventable. I like to talk about the five most important early screening tests for insulin resistance. In the course of the program, we're going to have a whole lot more. We're going to go into the labs in great detail. We'll teach you how to assess and how to look at those labs, how to read those labs. And I'm just going to cover the five most important ones tonight because I want to give you some stuff, then some juice that you can get started with right away. And the next person that walks through your door, it's somebody that you're already working with, that you can start to see them in a different light and maybe get some testing going to determine if this person really does have these early signs. And I want to just let you know that oftentimes as practitioners, we kind of have in our mind the kind of people we're going to look at in terms of this person might have insulin resistance. And it's usually a more sedentary person, large waist compared to hips, obese, people with diabetes in their family, people who explain that they have these, you know, massive blood sugar drops and then raises. But in fact, you can do screening on just about everyone, and I'll share my story in a bit about how I discovered that I had insulin resistance in the course of teaching this program. But because I had kept a lot of it under wraps, and a lot of the diet and lifestyle pieces were already in place for me, I wasn't showing it in those overt signs. No one would look at me and say, you have insulin resistance. And even to this day, if I'm not really careful about balancing all those components we're going to talk about tonight, I can get to the point where my blood sugar is going up. And with a family history of heart disease and cancer and diabetes and stroke, I don't want to go down that path. So I'm really careful. And a lot of patients may be like that. and you, in fact, yourself might be. We discovered in the last time we did this program, just a little over a year ago, that some of the people, the practitioners going through the program, discovered that they indeed had insulin resistance, and it was a real eye-opener for them to start to look and reverse that trend in them, and they got really motivated in terms of doing it with their clients. We're going to talk about the five most important steps to restoring insulin and blood sugar balance. We're going to go through in depth each of these as we go through the program. Yes. And then the five most important nutrients. There's a whole bunch of nutrients, and we have checklists in the program, and we have, you know, you'll be getting that as time goes on. We'll be releasing those at the appropriate times. But I want to talk about the five most important ones. Why? Because you can start to help people immediately by getting them on at least the top three of these. I'm giving you five, but at least the top three. You can get people to change right away. You can help them to balance right away. You can help them to get rid of the sugar cravings and the desire for sweets after a full meal and a lot of those things that keep them from doing some of the diet stuff they know they should do, but they can't because of the uncontrollable cravings. And we can physiologically manage those cravings, biochemically manage those cravings by using some of these nutrients. So the staggering statistics, it's really an eye-opener. And it's really sobering when you look at these statistics. As of 2011, which was the latest stat that I could find, 18.8 million people in the U.S. had been diagnosed with diabetes. That's about 8.3% of the population. This is huge. 8.3% of the population diagnosed with diabetes. And it's estimated there's another whole spectrum that hasn't been diagnosed. And you also have to remember that that doesn't count the people who are pre-diabetic, who are about a month away from diabetes in terms of medical stats, and medicine isn't labeling them that way. It's the seventh leading cause of death in the U.S. And the cost is, this is what's really sobering, $245 billion in 2012. Can you imagine if you could save the healthcare budget, $245,000, you can be part of saving that money. And a lot of the stuff that we can do can turn this around and get rid of that cost or a big portion of that cost. Insulin resistance, and we'll talk more about the difference between insulin resistance and diabetes in a bit in the spectrum, but insulin resistance, which is like pre-diabetes, a lot of medical practitioners will call it pre-diabetes, it's estimated to affect 1 in 4 in the U.S., about 68 million people. 1 in 4, that's 25% of the population. And that's just the ones that can be diagnosed based on the lab levels that medicine holds true. And this is, in effect, the underlying cause or one of the most serious underlying causes of why this is such a epidemic. The average American consumes 130 pounds of sugar in a year. That's more than 22 teaspoons per day for adults and 32 for children. And there's a link for where I got those statistics. It's pretty well known. So let's just see how much sugar that really is. That's an entire dumpster full of sugar. One person. That's one person. And I know I don't eat any. And you guys probably don't eat any or very little. So somebody's eating our share. Somebody's getting a lot more than that 130 pounds or 22 teaspoons. Can you imagine 22 teaspoons a day of sugar? That's not counting fruit. That's counting added sugars or sugars in baked goods and things like that. That's not counting like apples and things like that. That's sugar. So here's what it is. This to me was shocking. The American Heart Association recommends no more than 9.5 teaspoons a day. I mean, come on, is that a responsible recommendation? 9.5 teaspoons of sugar a day? Would you recommend that to any of your clients? Not hardly. And then the average adult, it's 22, and the average child, it's 32. So the biggest culprits are soft drinks, believe it or not. People are still drinking soft drinks, full sugared soft drinks, at an enormous rate. And of course, sugars and candies, you know, added sugar to coffee and tea, candy, people are eating that, like the M&Ms in the machine in the late afternoon when their energy's dipping, cakes, cookies, pies, fruit drinks, right? A lot of those fruit drinks, that's not even counting fruit juice, which is a high source of sugar, but the fruit drinks, those fruit drinks that are about 90% sugar and 10% juice. dairy desserts and milk, so ice creams and frozen yogurts and that sort of thing, and then other grain-based things. And you got to realize that it's not just in the obvious. It's not just in the desserts. Sugar is in everything. Pick up a jar of tomato sauce. You don't know how long I spend at the supermarket, at the Whole Foods, looking for tomato sauce for my kids that doesn't have sugar in it. You know, there's one or two brands that don't have sugar. It's added to everything. It's really staggering how much sugar there is in the foods that we're eating. Your body is equipped to handle sugar as part of a whole foods diet. And it's got the mechanisms for handling it and for managing your blood sugar. Your blood sugar needs to be maintained in a steady state within a pretty tight range. Fasting, I like to see it between 75 and 89. But at that level, you've got a steady supply of sugar that can be fed to your brain. The problem is if the sugar goes too low, your brain doesn't get enough glucose and you go into that state of like feeling like you're going to pass out, or brain fog, as a lot of people describe it. So there's a lot of parts to the body that are required to keep the blood sugar managed. It involves the pancreas, which secretes a couple of hormones, the liver, which controls the rate of fat storage and burning, and also glycogen, which is a storage form of starch, and then your adrenals. And your adrenals, when you get under stress, secrete adrenaline or epinephrine, and that will cause the breakdown of fat to produce sugar into your blood so that you can get the heck away from a hungry tiger. And then cortisol maintains that by doing a process called gluconeogenesis, and it prefers to break down protein, although cortisol can also trigger the breakdown of fat and of stored glycogen, etc. But its preferential is muscle tissue to break down proteins because it's quick and easy to break down. When your blood sugar gets too high, so you sat down and you ate the typical American meal that contains 22 teaspoons of sugar, then insulin is released by the pancreas to bring that level down. Well, how does it bring it down? Well, the ideal is that it takes the sugar and it allows it to be transported into your cells so that your cells can make ATP, energy, adenosine triphosphate. Okay? Once it does that, the sugar in the blood goes down, the pancreas stops secreting insulin, and everything is good. However, it also can cause the storage of that sugar into fat cells. So if you've eaten too much and the cells have enough, you'll store it as fat. Over time, if you eat a lot of sugar, the receptors on your cells get burned out. And that's the condition we call insulin resistance. And we'll look in a bit at how that progression goes. When the insulin resistance develops, instead of the sugar being shuttled into the cells to give you energy after a meal, it's shuttled into your fat cells, because the fat cells don't generally become insulin resistant. When your blood sugar gets too low, your pancreas secretes glucagon, and glucagon goes out and signals to the liver to release some of the stored glycogen. If there's no more stored glycogen, it triggers the release of either protein breakdown or fat breakdown to create the amount of sugar that your body needs to maintain that steady state. So the glucagon insulin is going on in pretty much all day in a cycle. You eat a meal, you get a whole bunch of sugar into your system, insulin goes up, the insulin gets, under normal circumstances, takes it into the cells, the blood sugar goes down. You're just at a state where maybe you've run out of fuel based on that last meal and it's haven't started the next meal, so the sugar starts to drop a little bit more. The pancreas secretes glucagon, does its thing, brings the sugar back up. But there's a lot of stuff that affects this whole process. Stress is one of them. The release of cortisol and adrenaline will stimulate the release of sugar from stores. It's affected by diet, obviously. If you're one of those average Americans who's eating 22 teaspoons of sugar, you better believe that your blood sugar management system is extremely stressed. It's also affected by genetics. It's said that about 25% of the population will not get insulin resistance no matter what they eat. They could eat that 22 pounds of sugar or 22 teaspoons of sugar a day, 130 pounds a year. They can just be constantly stressing that system and they won't get it because genetically they just don't have the mechanism to get it. And then there's about 25% that no matter what they do, no matter how careful they are, they have to be extremely, extremely careful they're going to develop it. And then there's the 50% in the middle who are going to develop it based on habits, based on good eating habits or bad eating habits. And those are the ones you're going to most affect. You will get a few of those in that 25% that they're really hard. You have to be really careful with them. And I've worked with those. You also, I've seen the people who are up at the other end. Somebody said to me, well, I wanted to test your theory of the blood sugar. So what I did was I made myself a smoothie and I put 8 bananas and, you know, half a box of spinach in it. And I drank it. And my sugar went from 85 to 95. Is that a problem? I'm like, no. Okay. And another person who put a handful of raisins in a big salad and her sugar went from 85 to 202. Is that a problem? Yes. So we have people at all ends of the spectrum. And what I want you to do is understand this well enough that you can know how to adapt and create protocols that these people can follow and share with them why it may not be working as well as their neighbors. It's working for the neighbor and how you can help them. So let's go into a little bit more detail about the normal insulin response to food. You eat. As a result of eating, your blood glucose rises. Your pancreas secretes insulin. The insulin escorts the glucose into the cells. Then the blood glucose decreases. Your leptin levels rise. Leptin is secreted by fat cells and it triggers fat burning. Your pancreas stops secreting insulin now. And then the increase in energy happens as a result of the glucose getting into the cells and being converted into ATP. And you feel good until you get hungry again several hours later. And we'll talk as the program goes on about meal spacing and what the ideal meal spacing is for most people and how to help people determine what the ideal meal spacing is for them. The whole concept of eating every 2 hours, I'm going to shoot a lot of holes into that. And you'll decide for yourself, but I'm going to shoot a lot of holes. I'm going to do my best to shoot holes into that because it doesn't make sense biochemically. It may make sense physiologically for certain people based on where they're at. And we have to be aware of that. But for the most part, a wholesale recommendation like that, I think it's dangerous, very dangerous. You get hungry and you eat again and the whole thing starts over. This is normal. This is what it should happen. So let's look further. In normal glucose blood sugar regulation, of course, you get a decrease in the blood glucose between meals, okay? Pancreas secretes glucagon, which triggers lipolysis, which is fat cell breakdown. It also can trigger gluconeogenesis, which breaks down the glycogen in the liver, which is a stored form of sugar in the liver. Your blood glucose rises. Under heavy extreme energy demands, so say you've eaten a small meal and then you're out there running and jumping and you don't stop and get another meal, after a while, the glycogen in the liver gets depleted. There's just so much that it can store. And then in addition to the glucagon, which is the normal response in between meals, the stress response happens and cortisol and adrenaline are released. And that triggers more breakdown of your muscle tissue. Adrenaline gives a quick in and it breaks down the fats, but cortisol more triggers the longer term breakdown of muscle and it breaks down the proteins into glucose. So this is a little bit of just, you know, the whole dance that they do, right? Low blood glucose triggers the pancreas to produce glucagon. High blood glucose produces the pancreas to secrete insulin. And then they do it their job. And then you achieve normal blood glucose. And you should be pretty steady throughout the day. And we'll talk more about what the good rise in sugar is after a meal and then when it should come back down to normal. All of this affects the body tissues. Let's talk about the brain a little bit because this is really important for you to understand and this is cutting edge stuff. The old thinking was, this is what I was taught when I was in school, is that the brain doesn't need insulin. It can transport glucose into the cells of the brain without it. It can cross the blood-brain barrier. But indeed, that's not true. throughout the entire brain. Yes, there are parts of the brain that can uptake the glucose directly out of the bloodstream and utilize it without insulin. But now we're finding that insulin plays a very significant role in the brain. There have been receptors for insulin found in very high concentration in the hypothalamus, which is your regulatory center of the brain, controls temperature and controls pituitary hormones, hormone levels. The cerebellum, which is in the back part of your brain and controls balance. People that get out of balance and don't have enough sugar get into the brain, kind of have that stumbling, kind of drunken sailor gait. The hippocampus, which is responsible for short-term memory. And then the cerebral cortex, the front part of your brain, which is responsible for the high-level thinking. So if your brain is not getting enough, if your brain develops insulin resistance, which we're finding can happen, didn't used to think your brain could, then these parts of the brain get affected. And so you'll have gaps in short-term memory, that foggy feeling of, why did I come into this room? What was I looking for? You get that kind of off balance, kind of, you know, staggering type gait. Some of the temperature regulation goes off. Your appetite regulation goes off. You end up with higher levels of appetite than you would before. And your high level thinking function goes off. So people will describe it as brain fog. I have my brain fog. And one of the primary causes of brain fog is insulin resistance in the brain, blood sugar problems. So it's really important, and there's a lot of research now that's looking at Alzheimer's as potentially being insulin resistance of the brain. And you talk about a condition that nobody wants to get. I mean, it's one thing to have a physiologic condition where you're impaired, but it's yet another to have your brain just go out to lunch and your body's perfectly fine and your brain isn't working. And I know people that have been through it, and it's not pretty. So let's talk about what happens in response to food when we have insulin resistance. So you eat a meal, the blood glucose rises, the pancreas secretes insulin. But because you've been eating a lot of sugar and refined carbs and you've been not sleeping enough and a lot of the other factors that go into causing the cells to become resistant, eating a lot of hydrogenated fats, which damage them, eating a lot of gluten, which causes them to be inflamed, a lot of causes, and we'll be going through all of these in great detail as the course progresses. Your cells become resistant to insulin. So the glucose stays high. So the pancreas says, whoops, high glucose. What do I do? Well, I secrete more insulin. High glucose, secrete more insulin. It just keeps secreting enough insulin until when it's not going down, the excess sugar is then stored as fat. It triggers that to be stored as converted to triglycerides and stored in your adipose tissue, especially around the waist. And then the excessive insulin, the high levels of insulin, create insulin resistance in the cells of your muscles and your organs, some of your organs. But your blood vessels, it don't become insulin resistant. What happens when your blood vessels don't become insulin resistant is that the insulin actually damages them and they become thick and inelastic, and there's a problem. And then you feel hungry right after the meal because your sugar is high, but your cells aren't seeing it. So you're not triggering that satiation response. And so you eat again. And what happens is you have this constant flood of insulin in the body all day long. And it becomes problematic. And very, very serious complications develop as a result. And we're going to look at what some of those are. So let's look at some of the underlying causes of insulin resistance. We'll be going through these systematically throughout the program to help you. We're not going to talk too much about genes. I talked about that already, but just some people have the genetics that predispose them and other people don't. Inadequate, and I should also say excessive nutrition, inappropriate nutrition. Too much sugar, too many carbs, too many hydrogenated oils, too many heated oils, oxidized fats that create oxidation and inflammation that damages those receptors. Stress. When you're highly stressed, you create a lot of adrenaline and cortisol, and those contribute to insulin resistance because they release stores and then your blood sugar is high. lack of exercise. You know that trained muscle becomes less insulin resistant than untrained muscle. So when you exercise, you're training your muscles to pick up the glucose from the blood, and you reverse your insulin resistance. So you have to have regular exercise. And we'll talk more about the details of that. I give you lots and lots of resources for that and lots of things that you can share with your clients. Lots of audios and videos and just lots of stuff that you can teach your clients. And sleep. And this turned out to be my number one problem when I tested my glucose and found out that I was insulin resistant. Poor sleep. And even one bad night of poor sleep, according to my research on many, many, many journals, is that one night of poor sleep can cause insulin resistance in even a healthy person. Now, yeah, it's a temporary insulin resistance if it's one night of poor sleep and you can restore it back in the next day. But if it's days, weeks, months, or years of poor sleep like me, and I don't mean poor sleep like I couldn't fall asleep. It's just like I'd never went to bed. I would just stay up all night and work because I felt like I had a lot of energy. But that, I think, was the key, because once I started to sleep, I would find that the things that made my blood sugar go up didn't make them go up as much. So when you're going to take all these things into effect, when you're talking to somebody to assess and to follow them and monitor them, and when they say, oh, my blood glucose is up, you're going to kind of go, okay, tell me about what you ate. Tell me about your stress yesterday. Tell me about your sleep. Did you toss and turn last night? And that's going to affect their fasting blood glucose and also their maintenance of glucose throughout the day. So let's just go through some of the causes of insulin resistance. I talked about genetics. By age 60, 40% of Americans have at least three markers for insulin resistance, and 60 to 70% have at least one. Omega-3 deficiency, especially DHA, contributes to insulin resistance. Those receptors need that in order to be able to pick up the insulin signal. If you've got an omega 6 to 3 ratio that's too high, and or you have trans fats in your membrane, we'll go through a lot of detail about this. So, you know, we'll go through that. I have a spreadsheet for you, and you can actually track for yourself and then teach your clients to track their ratios of omega 6 and help them to optimize that. And of course, trans fats, most of you probably know what they are, but you know, those hydrogenated fats, oxidized fats, damaging fats, they damage your cell membranes and then they can't pick up the insulin. Deficiencies of nutrients, and here's where we start to talk about some of your nutrients. Chromium, magnesium, zinc, B vitamins, boron and lithium have even found to have an effect. Lack of resistance exercise, manual labor, and trained muscle mass. So it doesn't mean you have to go to the gym. You got somebody who's working out in the fields or does manual labor, they're going to have trained muscle mass. You don't have to have somebody work out at the gym 3 hours a day. It's just really good quality exercise. Of course, sugar, processed foods, starches, fruit juices, sodas, those create insulin resistance. Stress via the high levels of cortisol. And then insufficient protein, which is an often overlooked one. And not just insufficient protein. Somebody may be taking in plenty of protein in their diet, but they're not absorbing. And we'll go through that when we do the nutritional section about how you can assess some of those things. So some of the symptoms that you might see, your clients may be suffering, that are hallmarks of insulin resistance. That excess belly fat, even in somebody who's thin, you see that a lot. Somebody comes in and they weigh 115 pounds, but they have a belly hanging over their pants. They have that muffin top. I know I worked with a couple of people in the program last year. You know, one person, she started out there, she weighed 100 pounds, but she had a muffin top, believe it or not. And now she doesn't. And she's beautifully shaped and she actually won a fitness contest because she followed these guidelines. Low energy, especially after meals. So it's because the sugar's not getting into your cells. It's like you're eating food and you're feeding your fat cells. Or your clients are doing this. And you're hungry even after a full meal for the same reason. You eat and it's just feeding your fat cells, so your brain doesn't get the signal that you're full, that you have the nutrients you need. People who have that mid-afternoon energy slump. And of course, that can be adrenal fatigue. But it's also related to insulin resistance when the blood sugar starts to drop. Sometimes people have that hyperinsulin secretion. They're resistant, and the pancreas finally secretes so much insulin it exceeds that, and then boom, it all drops down, and you get a low blood sugar slump. Or the low energy might just be the after lunch where nothing's getting in. The sugar is high, but it's all sitting in the blood, and then it gets stored away as fat. Focusing difficulties. It's really difficult to focus when your brain doesn't have the adequate amount of sugar. And then you're cranky and irritable if you miss a meal. Yeah? Who says that? Oh, I have hypoglycemia, as if it's just a normal thing. Oh, my blood sugar's low. I feel cranky. That's not normal. Your body should be just managing insulin and glucagon to keep you nice and steady. So if your clients are complaining about this, know that it isn't. There's something going on there. It's not just, oh, this person has to eat more often. Yeah, eating more often may help them to feel better, but it's not solving the problem. So let's switch gears and talk about early detection of insulin resistance. Also known as dysglycemia would be the early signs. They're not quite in the lab range to call them insulin resistant, which according to medicine, the lab range for insulin resistance is between 100 and 119. My book, and in our functional medicine practices, we should be looking at insulin resistance is anywhere from 90 to 100, or early insulin resistance. That's when you want to catch it. Somebody has a first morning fasting blood glucose that's between 90 and 100. That's an early sign of dysglycemia, early detection of insulin resistance. But that's just one. That's not the whole thing. So I highly recommend that you learn how to, and you teach your clients how to measure your own glucose at home. And like me, you should practice it before you start to teach it to people. And I was in for the shock of my life. Bought my meter, bought a brand new one. I had an old one and I couldn't find strips for it, so I bought a new one. And I'm sitting there at home, and I took my blood sugar, and it was about, I think it was about 8 or 9 o'clock at night. And I just come home from the store, and I just actually taught a class with somebody, a raw foods class, and I'd eaten something a few hours before. And I took my blood sugar and it was like 68. It's like, what? Why is my blood sugar that low? Then I look back to see what I had eaten. The last thing I had eaten was some kind of, you know, raw food cookie with dates in it that somebody had given me at this thing. So I'm like, am I having a hypoglycemic low, a reactive hypoglycemia that came from too much insulin? Huh? So let me just eat something and see what happens. And so I cut up some pineapple and I ate some pineapple. And within, I was anxious. Usually, you know, you're going to wait till the peak, and I'll show you some charts to show you when things peak. But you're going to wait, and I didn't. I'm like, okay, I'm going to poke my finger right after. It's 135. How could it be 135 so soon? Must be a mistake. I do it again. It's 140. I do it again. I just kept doing it, and it rose up to a peak at 167 at about 45 minutes after I ate the pineapple. And that's pretty typical. You'll have a peak. Your glucose will rise. It usually peaks somewhere around 30 to 60 minutes. Most people, it's 45. But you'll be able to teach people by the end of the course, you'll be able to teach people how to know what their curve is so they don't have to test it like I did every few minutes to plot it. But, yeah, I'm a scientist and I like to do that kind of stuff. Well, when I got there, I was hungry. And I was pretty hungry before I ate the pineapple. But after I ate the pineapple, I was even more hungry. Was that a sign of, insulin resistance? I was starving, and it was the point where I was like, I'm not going to eat anything because I'm going to test this. I want to see how long it takes for it to go back down, and I was going to be real scientific, but it was really hard. It was really hard. I just wanted to go in the kitchen and eat everything in sight. So I wanted to just monitor it and watched how I felt. The starvation was just overwhelming, and it went up, it peaked, and it wasn't until about 2 hours and 15 minutes later that my sugar came back down into what's considered a normal range of 85. And so I watched that and was like, oh, you have insulin resistance, girl. And I was adamant, how can I have insulin resistance? How can that possibly be? I'm thin, I have no belly fat, I have no brain fog, I have tons of energy, I'm clear-headed. Well, I exercise. I'm really good at doing stress management. And by the way, we're going to teach you a really good process that you can share with your clients throughout the program. And I, what am I doing wrong? And I realized, well, I wasn't so good at timing. And we'll talk about that as we go through. Timing is really, really important. And I wasn't sleeping enough. And of the, there were five pieces that I was preparing to teach people in a group and that I worked with people on. But I wasn't always true to it myself. I wasn't sleeping properly. I was staying up till 2, 3, 4 in the morning, not getting enough sleep. And that's when I started to really dig into the sleep research and realize that the sleep was super important. 3 out of 5 is not good enough. 4 out of 5 is not good enough. You got to get all 5 under control if you want to get the optimum. So getting a home glucose meter is really critical. Getting them to get their hemoglobin A1C tested. Hemoglobin A1C is the percentage of the red blood cells that are sugar-coated, glycosylated. They're sugar-coated and from having the blood sugar up high. And you can estimate the average blood glucose by the percent of hemoglobin A1C in your blood. And say, for example, the hemoglobin A1C is 5.6, which is right below the threshold where the typical labs say it's going into the early prediabetes stage. And at 5.6, your average blood glucose is about 118. My friends, that's not good. And you'll be learning very intimately what good numbers are. So that by the time you're finished this course, somebody will tell your glucose numbers. You're right on it. You know exactly what it means. There's also some stealth lab analysis techniques, and I'm going to share some of those with you too. Some other things that may not seem to be related to glucose, but that you can look at for early detection. Like triglycerides and HDL and their ratios. The waist hip ratio should be greater than or equal to 0.8 or greater than 1 in a male. Greater than 0.8 in a female or greater than 0.1 in a male is a problem. And that's an early sign of insulin resistance. It doesn't matter if it's just a little bit over that. If it gets there, that's a sign it shouldn't get there. And a male, anybody that has a waist over 35 inches, that's considered an early sign. And then we have a symptom survey, and I'll be sharing that in the program. You'll get to go through these symptoms and be able to share those symptom surveys with your clients and see how they're doing. I'm not going to go through this too much. We go through this when we go through measurements and the glucose tolerance and how to read them and all that. But what you're seeing here on the picture is a chart of normal blood sugars. So they just basically gave a person a high glycemic, a high carbohydrate meal at 7:30. You can see that their blood glucose is right before 7:30 were pretty flat. The people at the low end were down here with their blood glucoses in the 70 range. The ones at the higher end were in the 90s to 100. But most of them were, these were not diabetics. So these people all had blood sugars under 100. The highest one was about 100 or a little under, like 99 at the early part before they started eating. But you can see what happens. Typically, your glucose is going to go up and it's going to peak at about half hour to 45 minutes and then come back down and get back down to the average. I like to see it get back down to where it started within 2 hours for really good glycemic control. But the problem is a lot of docs are measuring, telling people to measure themselves at 2 hours and finding, oh, you're normal at 2 hours. Or for diabetics, they're telling them, if your sugar is back to 140 at 2 hours, you're good to go. And that can't be further from the truth. It should never go above 140. Retinopathy starts at 140, and we go through that in module 1 as well, diabetic retinopathy. So you want to keep that sugar in a realm that doesn't go above 110. The people at the lowest end didn't go above 100. So you want to keep it in a healthy range. And when you start working with people, you're going to see where they're at the beginning, and you're going to give them goals. And the ideal would be to keep it below 110, but you may not be able to get it there for a little while people are making the changes. So this is just an overview. We'll go through this in a lot more depth, and you'll get the charts, and you'll get a spreadsheet, and you can put numbers in and graph out your own and use that to graph out your patients. So this is a response to a glucose tolerance test. So even at the, if you look at the low end, even if giving this person 100 grams of sugar, they just hardly ever peaked at all. And the maximum in the normal people was just about at 150 after pure sugar. These are non-diabetics. So you can see that there's a lot of misconception about what normal sugars are and what should happen. And you're going to get intimately familiar with it. I just wanted to get you started here. What's called postprandial blood sugar means sugar after eating. That's what's overlooked in measurement. That's where you can come in and be that stealth sleuth that knows how to handle it. So studies of native populations show that exercise and whole foods have postprandial glucose that rarely goes above 100. So for this training, I'm recommending people stick to about 110. If your fasting glucose is high, but your hemoglobin A1C is normal, meaning that your average is low, it could be a vitamin B1 deficiency. And vitamin B1 deficiency is one of the hallmark deficiencies in people with diabetes. So if you're looking at somebody and their fasting glucose is like 110, but their hemoglobin A1C is 5.2, it's probably a B1 deficiency. And it's just throwing that out there at this point. There's a calculator that you can go online, and you can go there and you can type in the person's hemoglobin A1C, and it'll tell you what the average glucose has been over that period of time. You usually only measure the hemoglobin A1C every 3 months because it takes that long for the red blood cells to recycle, 3 to 4 months. So a normal non-diabetic level of hemoglobin A1C is considered between 3.5 and 5.5. We consider the ideal to be 4.5 to 5. So these are things that you can be looking at early on. As a result of insulin resistance, there's prolonged inhibition of fat burning. So the whole thing about eat every 2 hours to keep your blood glucose steady means that you have a steady stream of insulin in your system, which means that prolonged inhibition of fat burning. You're not going to be burning fat all day long. You're going to have excess belly fat. You're going to have decreased lean muscle mass and damage to the vessel linings, as I talked about before. And we'll go into a lot more details on how we're going to look at these things and reverse these things. You can have damage to your blood vessel linings as a result of the effects of insulin, because remember, blood vessel linings do not become insulin resistant. Plus, those glycosylated blood cells that the hemoglobin A1C is measuring, those are sticky and sharp. Think about what happens if you were to take some like molasses and heat it up and then drip it onto a countertop and then let it dry. It's like sharp and sticky. That happens to your blood vessels, and so it damages. I mean, it happens to your blood cells, and then it damages the blood vessels, causes inflammation, causes high blood pressure, causes your blood to thicken, causes you to retain fluids, and it can initiate cancer through oxidative stress and a substance called IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor 1. So these are the serious consequences of insulin resistance. So this is the kind of stuff you should be talking to people about if you suspect this. And they're like, now I don't have diabetes in my family. I don't have to worry about it. Well, in addition to the increased body fat, you end up with thyroid and growth hormone deficiencies. You have an increased cancer risk. You have high blood pressure, injury to blood vessels, systemic inflammation, the risk of Alzheimer's. If nothing else scares people, the risk of Alzheimer's should. I've watched people go through it, and it's not pretty. The thought of losing my mind and being fully body functioning is just, it's beyond me. And low energy to all your organs and glands. Let's talk about what I think are the 5 most important lab tests. It was hard to decide what the 5 most important are. So these are the among the top most important ones. Fasting glucose, of course, that's a hallmark. But know that the person, you're not going to diagnose the person as diabetic until it's above 120. But that range between 90 and 120 is really critical. Fasting insulin should be between 2 and 5. If it's higher than that, and this is a type 1 diabetic, you're going to see it really low for pathological reasons. But between 2 and 5 is a good range. Higher than that means that you're producing too much insulin, and you're going to be prone to insulin resistance. Triglycerides and HDL, critical. When you have elevated blood glucose, a lot of it gets stored into triglycerides, and the triglycerides float around in your bloodstream. And when your triglyceride to HDL ratio is off, which is barely ever talked about or measured, but really critical for insulin resistance. So what you're looking for is ideally a one-to-one relationship between triglycerides and HDL. So if your triglycerides are 75, your HDL should be 75. Your triglycerides really shouldn't go much above 75 or 80. Once they go above 90, it's considered insulin resistance. So if you have, that would be a really nice ratio, right? Triglycerides of 100, HDL of 100. Well, that's a little high for triglycerides. It's a little high for HDL. Most people don't go that high, but they're about equal. It can go as high as 2-to-1, but it should never be above 2-to-1. And 2-to-1's iffy because, like, okay, maybe you have 100 as triglycerides and 50 as HDL. Either way, they're too low. So really the ideal is 1-to-1. And then the hemoglobin A1C, of course, which we talked about, which gives you the long-term glucose control. These are things you can start right away with working with people and checking. You may have labs on people and just kind of pull some of the labs out and start looking at their triglyceride HDL ratio and pick up people who you didn't even realize were insulin resistant or heading that way. And then you have something to work with them on their next visit. Here's a table of lab marker patterns. Again, we go through more of this in the program as we dig in and do the measurements part. This give you an overview, but this is a nice chart to keep handy. The fasting glucose in the normal range, 75 to 89. Insulin resistant, 90 to 119. Official insulin resistance medically is between 100 and 119, so we can call it early insulin resistance between 90 and 99. Metabolic syndrome, which is an advanced state of insulin resistance, which also includes changes to the cardiovascular and high blood pressure and things like that. So you'll often see elevated cholesterol and all. That's greater than 100, and then so between 100 and 119, and diabetes is over 120. The triglycerides under normal should be about 75, you know, between 50 and 90. Insulin resistance is going to be greater than 90, metabolic syndrome greater than 110, and diabetes greater than 110. You're going to see that a lot in people. You see that elevated triglyceride a lot. The HDLs between 50 and 90 normal, less than 65 on insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome less than 55, diabetes less than 55. Doesn't mean if somebody has less than 55 on HDL, you can diagnose them as diabetes. This is what we're seeing as patterns. Fasting insulin should be, for normal, should be between 2 and 5. Insulin resistance, normal or greater than 5. It varies based on stage. You can see somebody with insulin resistance and still have like a fasting insulin of 4, but you're going to start to see it creeping up and all of metabolic syndrome, diabetes. You're all going to see those creeping above 5. And finally, hemoglobin A1C, like I said, ideal is between 4.5 and 5. Insulin resistance between 5.3, 6.5. Metabolic syndrome and diabetes greater than 5.7. So nice chart to keep handy. So we talked about the dangers, we've talked about the progression, we've talked about some of the labs, some of the ways to assess people. Let's just talk about the way that you're going to reverse this. And this is what the heart of the program is going to be all about. We're going to go through in detail the step-by-step assessing people, monitoring people, putting them on programs, and watching them soar, watching their health improve. You want to increase insulin sensitivity. We have certain nutrients for that. You want to decrease their need for insulin by decreasing the foods that cause the need for a lot of insulin. You want to reduce inflammation in their body. There's ways to do that. You want, because the inflammation damages the receptors. You want to optimize their fat burning and the lean mass building, and then minimize the impact of stress. I call it the candy bar eating effects of stress, because when you get stressed, it's like you eat a candy bar. That's how much blood sugar goes up. And who wants to have the effects of eating a candy bar when you didn't get to have the fun of eating the candy bar, right? So we're going to be looking at the 5 key lifestyle areas. And 4 of them are really lifestyle areas, and 1 is kind of an overall. Nutrition, stress, exercise, sleep, and timing. Remember I said earlier when I looked at myself, I did the checklist. I went, my nutrition's good, my stress management's good, my exercise is good. Blah, sleep no good. Blah, timing, well, sometimes I was, you know, eating dates and almond butter late at night, right before bed. No eating before bed. And we have a whole bunch of timing rules we'll share that you can share with your patients. And we have checklists and all. So hormone balances that we're going to study, we look at the hormone balances related to insulin resistance. There's insulin, there's leptin, there's thyroid, there's cortisol and growth hormone. It's not just about insulin. These hormones need to be balanced as well. And the things, the good news is the things we're going to talk about for balancing the insulin are going to help a lot of these others. One of the things people don't realize is that insulin and growth hormone, they're not friends, okay? They don't like each other. They don't like hanging out together. So whenever your insulin goes up, your growth hormone goes down. Well, growth hormone is needed for what? Growth and repair. Building lean muscle mass. Insulin's good for building fat. If you can't get the sugar into your blood, into your cells, it's going to do fat. So when you're eating a lot and eating frequently, you inhibit growth hormone, which kind of thwarts fat loss and lean body building. So let's talk about some of the things. We're going to talk about this in detail in the nutrition part. Reversing insulin resistance, avoiding trans fats, increasing DHA, decreasing the omega-6-3 ratio. We give you tools for all of that. We give you sources. Improve minerals, chromium, magnesium, zinc. Improve your B vitamins. Getting people doing resistance exercise and manual labor. Burst training. Avoiding, of course, the sugar, the processed foods, the starches, the fruit juices, and the sodas. All those things we listed at the beginning that are causing this problem. Reduce stress. And make sure they get enough protein and protein absorption. And we'll work on those kinds of things as well. Some rules, you know, I'm just throwing these in here. This is just to give you an overview, but these are some of the things we're going to be focusing on and helping you to get into place with your patients and clients. Don't eat after dinner. Eat only 3 meals a day. Sometimes that needs to be broken. Allow 4 to 6 hours between meals, really critical for leptin and insulin and growth hormone. Eat to full, don't overeat or undereat. And that takes some time. You're going to have to be coaching people and helping them to get to the point where they do eat enough without overeating so that they're not starving 3 hours later. Eat slowly and calmly. That affects the stress, that affects digestion, protein absorption, etc. Practice breathing and appreciation before each meal. One of your bonuses, which you already have access to if you're already in the program, is Transforming Stress. It's a 30-day Transforming Stress program, and we're going to be making that available to the general public at some point in time. And then starting your day with protein. And it doesn't mean bacon and eggs. You get these insulin resistance books and read them, and the diets are awful. They're having people do just a lot of meat and a lot of dairy and a lot of butter and they're very little in the way of vegetables. Vegetables are friends. Green leafy vegetables are friends. So you can do an insulin resistance program as a vegetarian or vegan, or you can choose to include animal products. And it's really important to be able to adapt to who your client is. I know there's a really good book by Dr. Mark Hyman, The Blood Sugar Solution, but all the recipes, they're not vegetarian friendly. They have meat in just about all of them. So all of our recipes are vegetarian friendly with the optional addition of meat for those people who need it or want it. Important to get rid of gluten. We'll go through this in very great detail because gluten affects autoimmune attack on the pancreas. There have been a number of studies that show that diabetic patients get worse with eating gluten and that insulin resistance worsens with eating gluten. We'll go through that in more detail. So let's go and let's summarize with the 5 most important nutrients. I usually call it 3, and I don't know why I said 5, so I usually like to start people with 3. So the top 3, I have people start when I first work with them, before I even have them start to give up the sugars and give up the foods, because these are going to help to balance those receptors so that the sugar starts to get moving into the cells more and the cravings go down. So chromium, polynicotinate form has been the one that's been most studied, 400 micrograms twice a day. Of course, you may adapt that to the size of the patient. It might be a little more in a very heavy person. It might be less in a very light person. Magnesium citrate, glycinate or natural calm. And we have a magnesium loading document to teach you how to train your clients to figure out what their ideal dose of magnesium is. DHA usually is between 350 and 500 milligrams a day, some people a little bit more. Usually use algae oil based, and there's a bunch of documents in the omega-3-6 ratios and spreadsheets and a lot of information for you. And then zinc, 30, 60 milligrams a day. I prefer liquid forms because it gets absorbed better. And liquid's super important for the protein absorption. If you don't have enough zinc, you don't make enough hydrochloric acid. If you don't make enough hydrochloric acid, you can't absorb your protein or your minerals. And you might know all that already, but we're going to make sure that you have this laid out in a protocol that you could teach people. And then finally, activated forms of B vitamins. I prefer liquid again because they get into the system. When I say activated forms, it's the forms that your body can use without having to do a lot of work on it. And when we're dealing with these people, a lot of them, their health is compromised. Their digestion's compromised. So you want to give them the most activated, easy to absorb form of things as possible. This is just a few other important nutrients on the site. We have a PDF file, which is a whole list of the different nutrients, the reasons behind it, the different herbs, the doses, and some sources where you can get them. You need to replenish the nutrients with food. A lot of programs out there are, the functional medicine stuff is awesome, except it overlooks a lot of the food and how to get people to be able to incorporate these foods. Like, just eat a healthy diet is not enough. Eat a balanced diet is not enough. You need to be teaching people, how do they get more green leafy vegetables? You need to be offering them recipes, and we have a ton of recipes in the program. Sea vegetables, chia seeds, flax seeds, hemp seeds for omega-3s, pumpkin seeds for zinc, Brazil nuts for selenium, protein powders for people who are protein deficient, and they, when they don't have good stomach acid, you need to give them highly absorbable forms to jumpstart their system. And then people who are not vegetarian, who prefer to have lean, organic, free-range animal protein or fish, you can use that in small amounts for your to get your protein, but make sure that you're taking adequate enzymes and stimulating hydrochloric acid, because you need to be able to break it down. And the more those statistics go down, right, though, that those millions of dollars that are spent on diabetes care, and all those pounds and pounds of hundreds of pounds of sugar that are spent, that are consumed, it's going to go down. And those sugar industry people are going to have to find something new. They're going to have to go into supplying herbs and greens and things like that. And you'll see them supplying green powders instead of sugar after a while, because nobody wants the sugar. That's what our job is. We're educating people to just question the norm, question what's in society, and take a step beyond that. And I applaud you all for being here. You're all making a difference in people's lives, and it's really, really valuable. So thank you so much.